Blog Talk Radio.
This is JJ Bomber. You are listening to Well Armed Radio.
Well, good evening, sheepdogs. Welcome to Well Armed Radio, where freedom is our best friend, sometimes our only friend. Thank you for joining us in our weekly vigorous, relentless, and sometimes ruthless pursuit of freedom. We are broadcasting live from the very Well Armed studio in New Berlin, Wisconsin. It's my pleasure to speak with the most informed gun owners in the state. That would be you guys. You are your community's finest. With a face for radio and a voice for silent movies, my name is Nick Clark, president of Wisconsin Carry and the host of Well Armed Radio, and encourage you to be a part of the show with your calls or by commenting in the chat function, the chat box here on Well Armed Radio. Phone number 563-999-3787, 563-999-3787. You can also interact with the show if you're listening through the MeWe page for Well Armed Radio. That would be MeWe.com/P/WellArmedRadio. And then there's a post today for today's show. And excuse me. If you comment in that, I'll see it. I try to keep one eye on that and one eye on the chat here. Speaking of the chat, we got Lon, my buddy from Wausau, is in the chat tonight. Lon, good to have you with us. And what a week. Start the show with the usual warning, no sacred cows here. First 15 minutes of the show is open line. Anything you want to riff on, anything you want to rant on, talk about, more than welcome. 563-999-3787. Man, I used to have that number sorry, let me quiet my computer down here. I used to have that number so well memorized with, turn my phone down too before that starts beeping in everybody's ear. I used to have my phone so well the phone number so well memorized right up until, again, I don't know why Blog Talk switched my phone number because I've kept the same Blog Talk account, but they changed the phone number on me. It used to be, what was it? I shouldn't even say it because I'll get it wrong. 646-746-8739. Oh, see, now I've almost forgot it. I think it was it though. Anyway, the new number, 563-999-3787. We'll get you through to the Blog Talk studio and this Blog Talk service in New York that'll patch you through to my studio, to my computer right here in New Berlin, Wisconsin. Also got, I see Ralph from Pleasant Prairie popped in tonight. Ralph, great to have you with us again. And Ralph's a longtime listener. And you know what? I got to tell you, I mean, just insane week, insane month, insane. I mean, it's just been, it's insane. It doesn't even feel like America right now. I mean, this is like a 50-year leap. What's happened in this country? And you look back, you see we've been sliding towards socialism, sliding towards, you know, a less free country for a long time. And I would say probably arguably since, I think the biggest jump was probably the New Deal. In the income tax, the passage of the income tax, that was probably, what year was that? I'm trying to remember what year income tax, I'll Google it. What year was income tax established? Oh, now my computer's frozen. Great. Oh, it's a day. Hopefully my web line isn't frozen. Yeah, hopefully. If you guys are listening, you guys in the chat on Well on Radio, Blog Talk Radio, excuse me, just give me a quick, all right, there we go. Now it's working again. Income tax was established in 1909, ratified 1913. So I would say income tax is probably one of the first examples of a big chop in the leg of freedom. Income tax would be a big one. That's not to say that all taxes are unjust, but income tax, taxing your income, you know, income a trade. There's taxing wages. Wages are a barter. Wages are where you have 24 hours in a day. You give 8 hours of those to your employer. Your employer gives you money in return. Ralph says FDR. Yeah, that's where I'm going next to this. The New Deal was the second. I think the big chop, you look at these monumental moments where freedom took a hit. And the income tax was one, I think probably one of the biggest ones. And then the next one, I was going to say what Ralph did, Franklin, the New Deal. I always call it the Raw Deal, the New Deal, the Raw Deal. Social Security, I think was the second where you can point to just big, big, huge loss of freedom. Excuse me. So, you know, you go back to September 11th, 9/11, I think there was some watershed year for losses of freedom there with the Patriot Act and some other things. There's probably some others, and honestly, there's probably some stuff that we don't even know about where freedom just took a hit. Stuff that goes on with the CIA and you know, alphabet soup agencies that if we knew, I've heard a congressman say, and many people, I've heard it from multiple people, that if we knew what went on in DC, the people would be there with pitchforks. And when a sitting congressman or a former congressman or someone who's been in DC says that, believe them. If we knew what really went on there, and we know it's bad, trust it's worse than what you think. So yeah, so income tax was the reason that, like right now, if you trade a car in, if I buy a $100,000 car and drive it for a month, and I trade it in for another $100,000 car, they give me $80,000 in trade. You don't pay sales tax on the trade value, because that was an exchange. If I trade with you, if I give you a gun and you give me a different gun, we trade. There's no, you know, that's not a retail. That's a private party sale. But that's not income as intended by, if you have money invested in a bank account and it gets interest, that's income. Wages are a barter, an exchange. You go work for someone, you give them 8 hours, they give you your time. That's a barter. That's an exchange. Now, one's a monetary exchange. But to tax wages is egregious in terms of freedom. To tax someone's, when that's a barter of your time for money. Income would be things like, okay, corporate income. Corporate income, when companies make income, that's legit as a target of tax because that is income. But wages shouldn't be looked at in the same vein as income. Anyway, not to get off on tangent there, but so you can look at these watershed moments over time where we took some big steps down that slippery slope of loss of freedom, slippery steps to socialism, slippery steps to totalitarianism. Whether those were big steps or just, you know, accelerations, they took place over quite a bit of time. I mean, some of those passed, you know, the New Deal, the Raw Deal passed it at one moment in time. Income tax was implemented one moment in time. But what we've seen this past year, I mean, I call it a 50-year leap because I think it took 50, I would say 50 or more, maybe 75. It took 75 years to go from a place of where we were in the early 1900s to the 2000s in terms of freedom here in this country, the loss of freedom. But the freedoms that we've lost in the last year, I mean, that's what I call the 75-year leap. And think about this. Think about what's in the last year. The freedoms that we've lost. So you start off with, I was trying to look and see if I had wrote, I didn't write anything. So you start off with coronavirus. Think of where we were 1 year ago. 1 year ago, the stock market's roaring. Trump had beat impeachment. That was February. February was when Trump beat impeachment. I mean, it looked like we were sailing, like Trump was sailing. There was no way Trump, I mean, there was nothing to run against Trump on. Just boom. The economy was booming, full employment, better than full employment, corporate profits up. I mean, it was just, and then coronavirus, and then these dictatorial lockdowns, and then Black Lives Matter riots and cities burning and the police doing nothing for the whole summer. And then sprinkle in a bunch of cancel culture within all of that. And then you get to fall and a stolen election. And then big tech censorship, what's going on with big tech censorship, which has just reached a fever pitch. The media saturation propaganda, just in the course, and the media's propaganda has been there for a long time, but it just, you know, you thought it was a fever pitch back in 2016. It's even worse. I mean, this year it's exponentially worse this year, the media propaganda. And right now the media propaganda is just, I mean, it's off the charts. It's not even measurable. The president of the United States banned from Twitter. The Communist Party in China still can be on Twitter. The president of the United States banned from Twitter. The Ayatollah Khomeini in Iraq or in Iran has a Twitter page. I mean, that's insane. And this is all in the scope of less. I mean, that's the kind of thing that you would think we knew we were going there. You know, that's where things go over time. Blue freedom seeps away from us. But that this was like a 50-year, maybe a 75-year leap in terms of tyranny. What's going on in the past year? You would have thought previously that's the kind of stuff it would. You look at that kind of change. It took place over 50 years, 75 years. 50, I use 50 years because they did it in less than 50 weeks. Less than 50 weeks, we went to a place that I would have expected it to take 50 years if the erosion of freedom had taken stayed on the trajectory it was. I mean, it's unbelievable. You guys, everybody knows what happened this week at the U.S. Capitol. So many things to say about that. But first, can you imagine being a combat vet? Think about this. Think about stolen election, the institutions that are supposed to provide remedy for injustice, courts, state courts, federal courts, refuse to hear the case. Smoking gun evidence out there, suppressed by all the mainstream media except for Newsmax, One America News, the Epoch Times, and a little bit of Fox News. But Fox News is getting pretty shaky too. But think about this. Think about being a combat vet. Think about what's just happened in this country in the past year, but recently just from the election on, where freedom is, I mean, and I said the other week, I think that we can now say we are not a free country. I've always pondered in the past, how free are we? Are we still the freest country in the world? How would you quantify freedom? And I looked at, well, the percentage of government spending versus the percent of GDP spending. You know, once most spending is controlled by government, you know, then you could say we're not a free market economy. We're more of a command economy. And we were approaching that. I think during the 2000s, George W. Bush's term and then Obama's term, we were getting to a point where of all spending, government spending was approaching, you know, 42, 43%. Once most spending at federal, state, and local levels was a bigger percentage of all spending than private sector spending, then I think you could say we're not a free market economy. We're more of a command economy. But now that this happened with the election, I mean, that to me is the unmistakable, that there's no question. We are not a free country. If you can't, if we are not represented by people that we elect, that's not, freedom's lost. I mean, freedom's gone. I don't think anybody could argue that any other way. And if you want to, 563-999-3787. Argue with me that freedom isn't lost when we are, the consent of the governed is a basic principle of our constitutional republic. And with a stolen election, they do not have, and I'm going to refer to it as the Harris Obama administration, because let's face it, Joe Biden is just a marionette. I mean, they're holding that guy up by strings and cane poles. That guy's just a marionette. Kamala Harris is a very powerful person. Obama hand-selected her. That's the reason that you'll recall it took so long for Joe Biden to pick. Kamala Harris doesn't check any of the boxes that you would typically pick for a vice presidential running mate. She's not from a swing state. That's something they used to do, pick someone from a swing state that'll give you a bump in that state. She's from deep blue California, which Biden was going to win anyway. So, but Kamala Harris is a radical. She's an Obama radical. And Obama's been behind calling shots behind a lot of this stuff. So that's why I'm going to refer to it as the Harris Obama administration. Okay, so can you imagine being a combat vet? You know, maybe 9/11, you were in high school graduating. You were, so that was, you know, around 20 years ago. So you're 18 years old. You join the military because you want to fight for freedom. You saw what happened in New York and Washington at the Pentagon and at you know, the plane that crashed. And so you enlist for the military. A lot of people did. A lot of people voluntarily enlisted. And then you knew you were going to combat. Because if you used to enlist in the, like when I was in high school, when you talked about enlisting, yeah, there was Operation Desert Storm from 1990 or 91. Real, real brief military operation. But by and large, I mean, Vietnam ended in what, 74? That's what the year I was born. So for a lot of us Gen Xers, there was no, we had never lived through a true war. We had lived through some conflicts, some, you know, military operations, bombings, air raids, that kind of stuff. I think, oh gosh, what was it? The Falkland Islands thing. These are just things I remember from my kid, my childhood. But when I was in high school, it was pretty much, if you were going into the military, it was because you wanted free college. That's how the recruiters portrayed it. They didn't portray it as, hey, you're going to go fight in wars. When you were recruited, when the recruiters came, it was always just, hey, you can get free college, pay for college, pay for college. That's what it was. So But after 9/11, that's when people that's when it was pretty clear that if you sign up for the military, you're very likely going to war. All right, got to give a shout out. Zach from New Richmond is in tonight. I'm now learning that I have to refresh my my page here for Well Armed Radio. So Zach from New Richmond is in as well. Zach, great to have you listening. And I'm keeping my eye peeled for any comments that are made on the Well Armed Radio page about the show. Gosh, my internet's been so slow today, just terribly slow. One more thing I want to find here. Sorry for the, you have to bear with me for a second because I was finding a quote and there it is. I've got this quote I was going to use later in the show and I don't want to, use it. See now, where the heck did that go? Zach, I'm looking here. I see your comment. Comments on your post. Zach from New Richmond is in, but why did it not? Oh, I get it. Zach was in. Okay. That's what happened. Zach's in the Wisconsin Carry group. It's hard for me to keep my eye in two places at once. Zach, if you make any other comments, if you go under the Well Armed Radio page, I'll see it. I can't promise I'll see it if you make a comment in the Wisconsin Carry group, because that's where I shared the post for tonight's show. Anyway, back to my angle here. Can you imagine being a combat vet? You enlisted after 9/11. If you enlisted after 9/11, you had a pretty good idea you could see combat. Again, different than the us children of the 80s and such that us late Gen Xers who, for us, the military was the Vietnam was over before we were born, or many of us right around when we were born, and so you don't remember it. And for your whole life, the military is really a place where you went, and it was just it was peacetime military. But imagine you saw 9/11, you were a senior in high school, maybe freshman in college, you decide to enlist in the military, knowing you might see combat, and you enlist for combat. I think when you go, I remember in the military, but I think when you go in, you choose what you do, and I don't know if people can answer this for me, if anybody in the chat knows. You choose to go into combat, correct? Or do they assign it to you? I don't know the answer to that. But I know you can kind of choose the branch of the military you go into. If you go into the Navy, you're probably not going to be, versus you go into the Army and you sign up for – do you sign up for the infantry or do you get placed in infantry? I don't know the answer to that either. But anyway – you're a combat veteran. You served in combat. You had bullets whizzing over your head. You had people firing at you. You were firing back at people. You risked your life. Close friends of yours that you became buddies with, blood brothers with, the people from across the country that you served in the military with. And when you go through those experiences, when you have, you're laying in a bunker with Iraqis or Afghanis or Taliban shooting bullets over your head, there's a bond that's formed there. When you're facing death with someone, there's a bond that's formed there. You have friends that get wounded, friends that get injured, friends that died, maybe close friends that died in combat right next to you. Maybe you're in a bunker and the guy right next to you takes a bullet in the head and he's dead. And that was your buddy. That was your best friend. That was your bunk mate or your roommate. I don't know how you referred him in the military. You did all that overseas, but you did it because you fought for freedom. You wanted to fight for freedom. You saw freedom was at risk, and so you thought the war is best. You were principled. You're motivated. You're passionate about. You did that. And so let's see, if you were 18 years old in 2001, Ed, so you're 38 now. You're 38. You're 40. You've been out of the military now. You're a veteran, combat veteran. You went through all that, and now you see. To watch freedom stolen here at home, you see an election where freedom was ripped away, and you thought to yourself, what the fuck did I go overseas to fight for freedom to have it stolen here at home? I can't imagine how combat veterans must be just livid. And it's interesting because I've noticed a lot of people who went into the Capitol they were vets, people that they've, some have been arrested now. Some have been, they were veterans. Ashley Babbitt, the girl that was shot, she was a veteran, served 4 tours of duty in the Middle East, gunned down by a U.S. Capitol Police officer. I think she was an Air Force veteran. Isn't it ironic that the rules of engagement, and if you've done any reading about the wars in the Middle East, the rules of engagement, especially under Obama, the rules of engagement in the Middle East, Afghanistan, Iraq, were unbelievable. I mean, the things that you had to experience before you were allowed to return fire, unbelievable. Clearly, the rules of engagement are looser in the U.S. Capitol for Capitol Police than they were for soldiers in the Middle East. Officers in the U.S. Capitol, apparently, the rules of engagement are more lenient for them than they were for our soldiers serving in the Middle East. But Ashley Babbitt served 4 tours of duty in the Middle East, gunned down by U.S. Capitol Police officer. Can you imagine that? She goes and serves in the Middle East and then ends up dying in the U.S. Capitol, shot by a government police officer. And of course, you know, she was unarmed. Should she have been in the Capitol? I mean, you know, see, here's one thing that I'm encouraged by. So you turn on the news this week, you turn on talk radio, not the news, you turn on talk radio, WISN, Rush Limbaugh. He was on a few days. He had some substitutes a few days. But one of the things that I was encouraged to hear was, of course, the people that are on the radio, they, and anybody on Newsmax, any of the anchors, they have to offer their obligatory, you know, we do not condone violence. We do not condone law breaking. We do not condone, you know, they all say, oh, blah, 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 blah. The people that broke into the Capitol, they should go to jail for, you know, the people that vandalized should go to jail for that. And there's some of that that I agree with, but what I've heard, and so all the hosts on talk radio, WISN, or hosts on conservative TV shows, Newsmax, whatever, they always put that out there. You know, we condemn the violence, condemn the violence. But the callers, I listen to these callers, and the callers seem to understand it. The callers seem to, not all of them, but I would say most of the callers I heard, they're like, you know, I understand why people went into the Capitol. Now, apparently there was according to reports, a U.S. Capitol police officer that got hit over the head with a fire extinguisher. He's the one that died. I don't know how accurate that report is. He died. That's accurate. But was it a fire extinguisher swung by someone entering the Capitol? I don't know that. That's what the report was. You know, that's clearly something that I would be against. But just people start. Here's the thing: if storming a Capitol, if going through windows into a Capitol building was illegal, or was worthy of being shot to death, then back in 2000 here in Wisconsin, we would have had a whole bunch of dead people because, if you might recall, first off, they stormed the Capitol. And they occupied it for like, what was it, 3 weeks? I don't even remember how long it was. It was a long time. Occupied it, desecrated it. I heard that there was urine and overflowing toilets and all this stuff. They cleared the Capitol to clean it after it was occupied by a bunch of union protesters for whatever it was, 3 weeks. And then they had a hearing, I believe in the Senate, to advance Act 10, to get Act 10 a vote or something like that. And the union thugs outside broke into the Capitol, broke in through windows, and then went to the Senate chamber and were pounding on the door of the chamber. And all the time screaming, this is what democracy looks like. How come when they're storming the Capitol in Madison, that's what democracy looks like? The news fawned over them like it was some romantic exercise in freedom. But when the Capitol gets stormed in D.C., it's an insurrection. It's a riot. It's a siege. The Wisconsin Capitol was put under siege. That was a 3-week siege or whatever it was. This was a 2-hour. I don't have a problem calling it a riot, but the reason I don't even want to say riot is because we shouldn't give liberals the pleasure when they refuse to call. Was anything burning in the Capitol? No. was any, and now here the exception now is if this police officer that died was indeed hit over the head with a fire extinguisher, that would be different. Was there any 70-year-old business owners getting hit with bricks and knocked unconscious by rioters in the Capitol? No. But all that happened in Kenosha, all that happened in Minneapolis, all that happened in Wauwatosa, across the country, cities burning, Seattle, Portland. And that was all romantically, I mean, there was CNN correspondents in front of burning buildings talking about how they were mostly peaceful rallies, mostly peaceful protests. But again, think of the combat veterans. Is this what you fought for? To fight overseas for freedom and come back and see this? And Ashley Babbitt, I mean, this, you know, I don't know how old she was, but younger white girl jumping through a window, unarmed, gunned down. I guess that's your white privilege. And immediately, just think about how unprecedented. Joe Biden, the first thing he does is he has a press conference, and the first thing out of his senile mouth is to play the race card, is to play the victim card by saying to people, well, you know, if that was some Black Lives Matter protesters that went into that Capitol, they would have been met with a whole different response. And the answer is bullshit. We saw the whole summer. What an absolute lie. And if you want to talk about who's fanning the flames of anger and outrage, they're right there. Joe Biden planting that seed in people's head, playing that victimology race card right away. But we don't even need to speculate. We saw also, and here's the thing, the public gets it. What I was going to make the comment about to people calling to talk radio, they seem to understand. The callers to talk radio didn't have much criticism, if any at all, for the people that went into the Capitol. Now, if I was there, would I have gone in? No. I don't want to risk my freedom. I don't want to risk my, I've just, you know, got too much to lose. But it's just, it's amazing the narrative. But here's the thing, and people get it. I saw something on the TV that President Trump's approval rating went up. Rasmussen poll, President Trump's support for President Trump went up after President Trump's support went up after what happened at the Capitol on Wednesday. And that doesn't surprise me one bit. So what I've said to people is, do be encouraged by that. Do be encouraged that there is 80 million people on our side. The Democrats stole the election. The Democrats occupy the White House, will occupy the White House. The Democrats have a slim majority in the House of Representatives and a very slim majority by way of Kamala Harris's tie-breaking vote in the Senate. But the Democrats know they did not win the hearts and minds of the American public. The American public wholeheartedly was behind Donald Trump. So be encouraged by that. Be encouraged by, you are not alone. People didn't side with, look, in 2008, Obama won with a cult-like following, and a whole bunch of people got buffaloed into believing that shit. You probably know people that are even, I don't know if I'd call them conservatives, but some smart, you know, maybe not too political people that just, they were on the Obama, maybe even tended to vote Republican, but they were on the Obama bandwagon. This was not that. This was not that. And here's the thing. The Democrats know they cheated. The people that filled out fake ballots, the people that paused the counts, they know how badly Joe Biden lost. And that's the reason we're seeing such egregious censorship in the media, such egregious propaganda in the media, because they know they lost. They know they didn't win the debate. They know that trying to win this debate on immigration for the last 4 years, trying to win this debate on, you know, by calling Trump a racist for 4 years, that didn't work. Everything they threw at Donald Trump didn't work. He gained support among the Black community. He gained support among Latinos. Probably gained support among the LGBT crowd. The Democrats know they lost. They got slaughtered in the arena of ideas. The economy soared without a single before. This is all before Coronanoia. The economy soared to the greatest economy ever. No stimulus, no new entitlements, no big government programs, just free market, taking the foot of the government off of the economy, and boom, look what happened. That's how well free market capitalism works. Capitalism won. This phony narrative about racism, the phony narrative about homophobia, the phony narrative, all those were defeated. So all the Democrats have left is to cheat, basically lie, cheat, and steal. And they're doing all three. And the reason that you're seeing this aggressive, egregious censorship is because they know they lost. They know they can't win in the debate of ideas. So the only thing that they can do is leverage their power and force people into submission. And anything that is not submission will be deemed aggression. All that they've now already assigned all the dog whistles. If you stop the steal, that's going to be termed, that has been deemed a dog whistle for violence. That's what they're going to do. What they have done is they've deemed that every single one of these things, whether it was stop the steal or audit the vote, all those things are going to be deemed to be inciting violence, and they're going to be prohibited. They're equating those things with yelling fire in a theater. Are you serious? Yes, I'm serious. They're equating those phrases with yelling fire in a theater. Someone was on TV this morning using that example. They say, well, freedom of speech, you can't yell fire in a theater. And what Donald Trump said to the crowd when they said, we're going to go to the Capitol and we're going to let them hear our voice, that's essentially yelling fire in a theater. That's how these people think. Tom Six just popped into the chat. Tom, great to have you with us. So this is some scary stuff that we're going through, that we're seeing. But do understand that there's 80 million people that feel the same way you did. We have the majority. We are the majority. But how do we leverage that? Certainly the free states, the states with Republican governors who aren't. And I'd like to make that comment too. People wonder how quickly Mitch McConnell has turned on Trump. And I can tell you why. The exact reason for that, let me give you a scenario. You don't understand, because see, Trump was winning and Trump was so popular. First off, there's a lot of jealousy. Have you ever had a politician? I don't even think they did it for Obama. They went to Obama's rallies. They cheered for him. People went to Trump's rallies by the tens of thousands, and they said, we love you. We love you. We love Trump. They don't do that for fucking rock stars, and they did it for Trump. But some of you might be wondering, well, how come all these Republicans that were supporting Trump and Trump was winning, why aren't they still more supportive now? And here's why. Because there's a lot of Republicans that only supported Trump because they had to, because he was the president and because he was winning and because he was so heavily supported. Now, Trump was the election was stolen from Trump. Trump will not be the president for the next 4 years. All these people just got reelected. I think Mitch McConnell was one of them. Lindsey Graham was one of them. Now these people that are speaking against Trump. And they care more about their political future than anything else. That's how it works in D.C. But here's some other things. When people try to understand like the D.C. swamp and why Trump was so despised. Remember one example. Remember when Trump lowered drug prices? And he was saying in one of his addresses, he said, believe me, there were Republican senators calling him, begging him not to do it, begging him not to lower drug prices, whether it was for, I don't know if it was for insulin or whatever, begging Trump not to lower drug prices. And there was Republican senators calling him, begging him not to do it, and he did it anyway. These Republican senators, they have their donors from Big Pharma, and historically, they were able to, quote, produce for their donors. If their donors said, we don't want this, put an end to it, all Mitch McConnell or Lindsey Graham had to do was call the Republican president and say, hey, please don't do this, and then they'd find a reason not to do it. or they'd find a reason to make a carve out for Big Pharma somewhere somehow. But Trump said, no, to hell with it, we're lowering drug prices on these generic drugs like insulin that the prices had just skyrocketed for. Senators hated Trump for that because he wouldn't let them do what they've been doing for decades, for generations. And that is throwing their power around, using it to fulfill favors for their donors, their corporate donors, their political donors. That's just one example of how Trump wasn't playing the game in D.C. and people hated him for it. Republicans hated him for it. But some other things I'd like to say here real quick. With all this big tech censorship, one of the things I want to say is, because there's a guy on Well Armed Radio said it. He's in Wisconsin Cary too. And I said, when it comes to this big tech censorship, in fact, I thought this was a pretty good comparison. To the people on the left, this is what I said on Well Armed Radio, to people on the Well Armed Radio page, to people on the left who are happy about what I call it twatter, what twatter and fascist book did to President Trump today, which was yesterday, and thousands of others recently, you are not a Democrat, you are a full stop communist. This is the crap communist China does. No true American would support this. What do I mean by that? Even if you're a Democrat, even if you're a liberal, I'm a Republican, and I love to see Democrats lose. I love to see them lose at the ballot box. I love to see them lose in the vein of ideas. But never once have I thought they should ban CNN. Never once, even though CNN is nothing but fake news. I've never once thought, I hope the FCC pulls CNN's license for fake news. No, I've never once thought that. Even though I hate CNN, and I think CNN is so destructive for this country, I've never wanted to see CNN go away. I've wanted to educate people. I want people to know how ridiculously biased CNN is. I want people to know how ridiculously biased Fox 6 in Milwaukee is. I want them to know how ridiculously biased the local networks are. Channel 4, NBC 4 in Milwaukee, WISN 12 in Milwaukee, CBS 58 in Milwaukee. I want people to know how biased they all are. But I don't want any of them forced off the air. I hope that so few people patronize them that they end up either having to, because the free market fixes all. You stop watching those effers, they can't sell ads. They either realize, hey, we got to do a better job of being honest journalists, or they do go out of business and someone else buys their broadcast rights to that television frequency. But never would I wish, and if the FCC did it, if the FCC came in and said, hey, we're going to shut down CNN, I would be against it. I would stand for CNN. But liberals aren't like that because they have no morals. And the liberal platform is immoral in and of itself. These liberals that are happy to see this censorship, again, don't call yourself even a Democrat. Call yourself what you are. You are a communist. Then this guy, Matt, on the Well Armed Radio page, he says, when I say you're a full-stop communist, Matt says, they are a full-stop private company. Did people suddenly forget that First Amendment protections are between the government and private citizens, not private companies and private citizens? You signed their terms of service. Love seeing the, quote, no true Scotsman fallacy show its ugly head again. All right, let me tell you something, Matt F. First, if you don't think that the Harris-Obama administration was behind, the government was behind forcing these private companies to do these things, you're beyond naive. But second, there's a whole bunch of laws, antitrust laws, that prohibit what big tech is doing. And I highly suggest people read them. Now, first off, I didn't even make a comment. When I said this thing about to those on the left who are happy about what Twitter and Facebook did to Trump today and thousands of others reasons, you're not a Democrat, you're a full-stop communist. I'm talking about citizens. I'm talking about just liberal voters. If they're happy about what Twitter and Facebook did, they're communists. That aside, so I didn't bring up the first, I didn't say, I'm not an idiot, Matt F. I'm very confident I know constitutional law better than you do. So I didn't bring up the First Amendment. I'm talking about from a philosophical standpoint, from a political belief standpoint, anybody on the left, whether you're an elected lefty or you're just a lefty voter, if you support what Twitter and Facebook did to President Trump today and thousands of others recently, you're not a Democrat. You're a full stop communist. That's what communists do. If you want to go there, if you want to go towards legality, there's a host of antitrust laws that prohibit what big tech is doing. And I highly suggest people read them. They won't, but I'm going to read something from this. Here's a quote from the Sherman Antitrust Act, and I studied this in economics. I studied it in college. The Sherman Act outlaws, this is a direct quote from the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission website. The Sherman Act outlaws every contract, combination, or conspiracy in restraint of trade and any monopolization, attempted monopolization, or conspiracy or combination to monopolize. Read that again. The Sherman Act outlaws every, for those of you who don't know, the Sherman Antitrust Act, it became evident to people in government long ago, I think it was in the 1800s, that companies could get so big that they could stifle competition. Facebook has done this over, once Instagram became the biggest, fastest growing social media network, Facebook bought them up. I guarantee if, that's monopolistic behavior. People say, well, competition fixes everything. Well, again, if as soon as something gets big enough to compete with Facebook, Facebook buys them out, that's classic monopolistic behavior. That's what the Sherman Antitrust Act is all about. Just to use another example, back in the 1970s, Ma Bell, it's called Ma Bell, the Bell companies, they controlled the entire nationwide phone system, especially long distance. And that was a private company. So if Ma Bell had decided back in the 70s to not allow Republicans to use the telephone, would you say, well, it's a private company, Ma Bell can do what they want? You wouldn't say that. You'd say it's wrong. Well, that's essentially what we're what's happening here is these monopolistic companies like Facebook and Twitter, they're conspiring, and that's part of the Sherman Act. There's a conspiracy to monopolize social media. So if anybody tells you, oh, the First Amendment, it's a private company, the First Amendment, you sign their terms of service, this is a conspiracy much larger. Look, it's no coincidence that in the same day that Parler, or excuse me, that President Trump gets banned off Twitter, says he's going to go to Parler, that the Google Play Store and the Apple Store both decide they're not going to let the Parler download come from the Apple Store. Is it called the Apple Store? Yeah, or the Google Play Store. That's not a coincidence. That's a conspiracy. It's no coincidence that now that Parler can be side downloaded, you don't need the Apple Store, you don't need Google Play for your Android phone. You can get the app other ways. It's no coincidence that Amazon Web Services, which Amazon is into a whole bunch of stuff, and one of the things that Amazon does is they host server farms. Just like server farms used to be hosted by, oh, I'm trying to remember if like Network Solutions was, but there was these big companies that just, that's what they did is they housed servers. Well, Amazon got into that business of housing servers and hosting websites, all kinds of websites, you know, not just Amazon's own websites, but Amazon built up this IT department and these servers to run their stuff. And then Amazon said, hey, we've got such an infrastructure here, we can host other people's stuff. So Amazon hosts all kinds of websites for all kinds of people, private companies, whatever. So now Amazon Web Services is saying, no, we're not going to let Parler, we're not going to host Parler anymore. So Parler is going to be shut down. I think at midnight, Parler gets shut down off of Amazon Web. Now, there are other hosting providers. Believe you me, the Harris-Obama administration is probably going to be reaching out to all those other providers and putting pressure on them, threatening them to not host Parler either. So don't think for a second that you have to just, that this is legal, that this is constitutional, that this is just something that, you know, don't let anybody, and I don't know this guy, Matt F. on the Wisconsin Carry page and the Well Armed Radio page who's pushing this stuff, but don't believe it. What Facebook and Twitter twatter, fascist book twatter, Amazon Web Services, what they're doing is illegal. It's a conspiracy against trade. And it's illegal. And it's been illegal for It's been illegal for over 100 years. So having said all that, let's just have a debate. And this is just for debate, but this is a serious question. After Wednesday and the Capitol trespassing, the trespassing that went out of the Capitol, we've heard from everyone in the Republican Party who had a microphone and a television camera stuffed in front of their face, violence is never condoned. We've heard that over and over this past week from Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and today. So this begs the question. I'm going to pose it to you guys. I'm going to pose it to listeners of Well-Armed Radio. What is the point of the Second Amendment? It's been stated and repeated, and especially in the last 10 years, it's become more widespread, that the Second Amendment isn't about hunting. It's about protection from tyranny. So, when would it be okay? I'm just asking the question. If the Second Amendment is here to protect against tyranny, it's not about hunting. It's not about concealed carry. The Second Amendment is not here to protect you. Our founding fathers did not put the Second Amendment in place so that you could protect yourself against an armed robber, so you could protect yourself against a home invader. The Second Amendment is here as a guard against tyranny. So if violence is never condoned, I'm asking, this is an academic discussion, when would it be okay to exercise the Second Amendment against tyranny? Again, hypothetical question, because, I mean, tyranny's here. We've had a stolen election. We've got government dictatorial actions the past year that have destroyed livelihoods. Every institutional form of redress, courts, state courts, federal courts, has refused to hear the case. So the question I pose is, when and in what way would the Second Amendment be morally put to use? Because the Second Amendment is here to prevent tyranny. It's here as a guard against tyranny. So what does that mean? It's a gun. It means you have to be able to use that gun to. So how is a gun useful against tyranny if, quote, violence is never condoned? Again, purely hypothetical question here. When and in what way would the Second Amendment be morally put to use? Is the Second Amendment only your prevention against tyranny when the government comes to your house to protect you? You go down in a blaze of glory? Only when they come there to your house to arrest you? I mean, if they come, they're going to have a warrant. Is the Second Amendment just a theoretical deterrent? If the Second Amendment's just a theoretical deterrent, if knowing that all these citizens have guns is going to keep the government from doing some really tyrannical stuff, if it really becomes apparent that it is just in theory, then it's not a deterrent. Because if any notion that citizens would ever use their guns against tyranny is dispelled, is frowned upon, is a social faux pas, then there is no deterrent. I do believe that liberals fear armed citizens. But if the, quote, right, if conservatives, if Republicans, if the right succeeds in vilifying any and all violence, then I pose a question, does the Second Amendment lose its deterrent power? I'm not saying we're there. You can decide that for yourself. But when the Capitol was stormed on Wednesday, I'm telling you, there was a lot of people in this country, and if you listen to talk radio, you heard the callers that say it, they were okay with that. They were okay with that wake-up call. They were okay with politicians being scared. I mean, think about this, these politicians, and funny how Once the violence is on the doorstep of the politicians, oh, well, then all of a sudden, violence is never okay, and it's a riot, it's a siege, it's whatever. Because when it was a Republican in Madison, and when the Madison Capitol was occupied with violent and threatening thugs, that was what democracy looked like. All summer, when businesses in Kenosha were burning and businesses in Minneapolis were burning and businesses, and when if you had a business in downtown Seattle, you were screwed. And the people in D.C. just kept right on doing their thing, enjoying the high life. There was no universal call for the... There was actually resistance to sending in the National Guard. President Trump offered to send in the National Guard to Seattle whenever they wanted it. They never, and there was resistance to that. So these elitist pigs in government sat there in D.C. all summer and watched the rest of the nation burn. And even D.C. had some riots in it. But as long as it wasn't the Capitol, as long as it wasn't their place of work, as long as it wasn't their livelihood, a government paycheck, as long as it wasn't there, eh. But as soon as it was them, look at the, even from Republicans, as soon as it was them, they couldn't get to a TV fast enough to condemn the, quote, violence. In order for the Second Amendment to have deterrent power, there must be a point when it would be morally justified to use your guns, the tyrannical government. So my question is, when is that? Now, I'm not joining any formal militia. I don't take orders from anyone. But when is the Second Amendment usable? I've always held the working belief that in the hands of private citizens, the moral use of a firearm, aside from hunting and recreation, is in a defensive manner. Military use is obviously different. Like a war is offensive in some circumstances, though you could say that a just war is defensive and justification. You could say that the war against Afghanistan was a defensive war. They attacked us. We defended ourselves by, you know, so. But I've always had the working belief that in the hands of a citizen, the only moral use of a gun outside of recreation, shooting, whatever, the only moral use of deadly force is in self-defense. But with tyranny in mind, knowing that's the core purpose of the Second Amendment, I would say, how is a firearm defensive and useful? Do we have to wall ourselves out in sanctuary cities and live in peace until the government soldiers show up to arrest us, and then it's okay to use your guns to protect yourself from a tyrannical government? Are we to live individually till we take a stand and decide not to pay our taxes or something, and then when the government shows up, we go down in a blaze of glory? But that's all it would be, because the government would happily dispose of us one rebel freedom lover at a time. And it would only take doing that to a couple of us till the rest of the people would realize resistance is futile. And the Second Amendment has no teeth. So it's easy to envision the defensive use of a firearm against looting. It's easy to envision the defensive use of a firearm against an attacker, a home invader, an armed robber, an angry mob. But I'm posing the question here to think about, when is it okay to use the Second Amendment against tyranny? Because that's a gun that is, quote, violence. When's that okay? What, I mean, because I would argue that stealing elections, and I mean, this is pretty damn egregious when we talk about tyranny. And I'm not saying we're there, but I'm saying what would there be? What would be the there? A couple of the guys that got in the chat here, I mean, and the guys that are listening on, that are chatting through MeWe, on the MeWe page. Do you understand where I'm going with this one? Like, what would, if violence is never justified, that can't be the operative mindset. We can't say violence is never justified. If they want to say violence isn't justified yet, okay, can have that discussion. But to say that violence is never justified, like a lot of Republicans did this week on TV, that can't be true, or there wouldn't be a Second Amendment. If there's a Second Amendment, there has to come a point when violence is justified. And I'm just posing a question academically, when and where is that? If I had the answer, I'd tell you. You know, a couple weeks ago, I said, I don't know what's going to happen. I have no knowledge or heard any rumors about any big things, but I knew something big was going to happen. I'd say Wednesday was pretty big. But I still think there's bigger things that are going to happen. There's just too many people, and there's too many people pissed off. Tom says violence justified in defense of, he didn't answer, and that's all I said. But that's, again, that's what I'm saying. We've heard this week after the Capitol was, after people broke, pushed into the Capitol, we've heard from even the Republicans, violence is never condoned. Violence is never justified. And we've probably heard that from every pundit on TV, from Tucker Carlson to, you know, some people on Newsmax to But this was my question. I'm going to pose again, and this is the one that I'm kind of curious if anybody has any thoughts on. When and in what way would the Second Amendment be morally put to use? Again, I'm not joining a militia. I'm not joining a militia to go invade the Capitol or the White House after the Harris-Obama administration takes over. But seeing how this country has taken this 50-year leap forward in tyranny, it just raises that question in my mind of when are we there? When is when are the protections of the Second Amendment going to be morally exercised? And in what way? Because if that's just a totally theoretical thing, it has no power, not as a deterrent, and not from a practical standpoint. So yeah, I'm just curious anybody's thoughts. You know, whether you got them now. Shoot me an email. Any of you guys, people, some people listen to the show live. A lot of people listen on the podcast. What is the Second Amendment? When the second we know the Second Amendment is about protection against tyranny. If that's just theoretical, if the founding fathers thought that just people exercising that would prevent tyranny from ever happening, then either this isn't tyranny or the Second Amendment didn't work. Because if this is tyranny, then it would seem to me that the Second Amendment's time has come. If this isn't tyranny, what is? It's a question for thought. And the next time someone says they support the Second Amendment, when next time a politician says that, and then they go to D.C. and they say violence is never okay, those two things, you can't say never. Again, if they want to say we're not there, then we're not there. Tell me why we're not there. Where is there? What's the there? What's the benchmark? What's the benchmark when we say, hey, that's it. That's it. That's too much right there. Is it when the government comes and just starts rounding people up like concentration camp style? Because they ain't going to do it that way. There's clearly some people super pissed. Again, I would have loved to go to DC for the rally. I don't have time. If I was there, I wouldn't have gone to the Capitol. Although I do wonder if there was people close to the Capitol, Like, I didn't even know the Capitol wasn't open to the public. I would have thought anybody could walk through the Capitol. And again, maybe on when there's these big, you know, protests, rallies, whatever, they close it because they can't handle the volume of people, maybe. But I mean, I was always under the impression that you could just go walk into the Capitol if you wanted to. I didn't know you couldn't. In Madison, you can. When I go to the Capitol in Madison, and I have an appointment there, you don't have to check in with anybody. I think there is security now, but they don't ask you, who are you here to see? What are you here for? You just go in through the screening and you're in. You could walk into the Capitol tomorrow in Madison. Although I think because of Corona, it's closed. But prior to that, when I was there last spring, doing a piece for Spectrum News One. That was a gun control issue piece. Panel discussion. What else we got here? So I wasn't able to solicit any takers to my question. Or is that, am I making sense? Do you understand where I'm going with that one? Does that, do I strike a chord? Has it given you pause to sit there and think, yeah, well, you know, I see what Nick's saying. Like, when is, if violence isn't justified? Now, don't get me wrong. I know there's some Wisconsin Carry members who I've seen say, we should be shooting by now. And again, what does that mean? Our founding fathers would have been shooting by now. What does that mean? Who would they have been shooting? Are they suggesting our founding fathers would have organized? It was different in the Revolutionary War because they sent troops from England, and there were, excuse me, troops from England. And when they came marching into towns or something and I don't know specifically when the redcoats were coming into a town, what were they going to do? Were they looking for certain people? Were they, you know, I don't know. They were met with armed citizens. We know that. But yeah, so I'm curious. I hope I hear from someone on that one because that was kind of my favorite topic of the night here, is that question about, you know, that's the hard, I mean, we're Second Amendment folks. So if we're Second Amendment folks, what's up? I mean, if we're Second Amendment folks, isn't that something that you've thought about? I know a bunch of you are stocking guns. Are you only stockpiling guns for civil unrest? Are you only stockpiling guns and ammo for when there's riots and you got a bunch of looters coming to your house? Next thing I was going to talk about tonight was a decision came out of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. You guys probably didn't see about all the other stuff going on this week. Wisconsin Supreme Court upholds gun ban for deadbeat dad. This is an article in the Journal Sentinel. Bruce Vilmetti was the author. Bruce contacted me this week. I saw this first, and then Bruce contacted me. Bruce Vilmetti sent me an email on, I think it was Wednesday night, asking for my, maybe no, it's Thursday. It was Thursday. Bruce Vilmetti sent me an email on Thursday asking for my Wisconsin Carry's reaction to this. So what happened here is there was a case in front of the Supreme Court that put the first, it's a case that sought to put the first dent in Wisconsin's ban on felons possessing guns. Read from the article here. Wisconsin Supreme Court on Thursday rejected a constitutional challenge from a man who became a felon for not paying child support. The ruling upheld the conviction of LaVon Roundtree, who had argued the law is unconstitutional in his case because his underlying felony conviction was for a nonviolent offense more than 10 years ago before he was found with a gun, convicted, and sent to prison. But the majority in the 5-2 decision said the law banning all felons from possessing guns forever is substantially related to the important government objectives of public safety and reducing gun violence. Roundtree, 52 of Milwaukee, argued the law should be subject to what is called strict scrutiny, that is, narrowly tailored to advance a compelling government interest. The majority noted that even recent U.S. Supreme Court cases seen as strengthening the Second Amendment rights say that some limitations, including bans on felons having guns, are presumptively lawful. There's a quote. The legislature did not, in Wisconsin Statute 941.29, subsection 2, create a hierarchy of felonies, and neither will this court. The majority cites research that found nonviolent offenders are more likely to commit new crimes, and that in Wisconsin, nearly a quarter of such recidivism is in one study committed of committed a violent crime. Justice Rebecca Bradley and Brian Hagedorn each wrote lengthy dissents. Now, that's a good thing that there was two justices who dissented to this decision. So what you had here is a guy who was a felon only because he didn't pay his child support, can't own a gun. If I was on the court, I would have ruled in his favor that you shouldn't be prohibited from owning a gun just for having a nonviolent felony should not prohibit you from owning a firearm. I would have been in the minority. Only Justice Rebecca Bradley and Brian Hagedorn wrote. And I was surprised because we've all been disappointed in Brian Hagedorn. I call him Jagedorn. We've been surprised at Brian Hagedorn recently on some of his rulings on election issues, on some of his rulings on public health order issues. Here's a quote from Rebecca Bradley. Under the majority's vision of what is good for society, even if a felon has not exhibited signs of physical violence, it is reasonable for the state to want to keep firearms out of the hands of those who have shown a willingness to break the law, Bradley wrote. It may be reasonable to the majority, but it sure isn't constitutional. Permitting restraints on the right to keep and bear arms that were never contemplated by the framers, this is the dissent by Rebecca Bradley, permitting restraints on the right to keep and bear arms that were never contemplated by the framers lends an illegitimate quality to the legislative power to regulate a fundamental right, thereby deflating the primacy of the Constitution and imperiling the liberty of the people, Bradley wrote. Bradley notes that people convicted of violent misdemeanors, like battery, don't face the same prohibitions against guns as those convicted of nonviolent felonies. That's a great, great comparison. Think about that. Rebecca Bradley noted, you can have a violent misdemeanor like battery, disorderly conduct, and you don't face the same you don't lose your right to keep. There are people that have a conviction for battery, misdemeanor conviction for battery, beating someone up, and they can get their concealed carry license, they can possess a gun. But here's a guy who his only crime was not paying his child support, and he can't own a gun. Hagedorn agreed with the majority's application of less than strict scrutiny of the felon dispossession law, but concluded that the state fails to meet even the burden showing, at best, modest correlation between banning the likes of Roundtree from having guns and preserving public safety. His opinion includes a detailed history of the right to bear arms going back to English law and the relatively recent state and federal statutes restricting firearms possession by those convicted of an expanding array of felonies. This is Hagedorn's quote. To be sure, felon dispossession laws have been in the books for some time now, but those laws are of 20th century vintage. They do not date back to the 18th or 19th centuries, the relevant time periods when the Second Amendment was ensconced as an individual constitutional right, Hagedorn wrote. In 2003, Roundtree was convicted of multiple counts of failing to pay child support for more than 120 days. In 2015, while executing a search warrant of Roundtree's house, police found a handgun and ammunition under his mattress. He said he had purchased the gun from someone on the street and did not know it had been stolen from Texas. He pleaded guilty to possession of a firearm as a felon and was sentenced to 18 months in prison plus 18 months of extended supervision. So that's the story from Bruce of the Journal Sentinel. So some reason to be optimistic on Brian Hagedorn, because I've been honestly concerned as I sit here with Wisconsin Carry's role. Litigation has been by far our most successful venue. We haven't done very well. We did really well with constitutional carry. We working with Senator Galloway, we had that to the floor of the Senate before that was amended to a shall issue permit system. But everything else we pushed for, school grounds carry, constitutional carry, since then, we have not been successful. But we've been really successful with litigation. We've taken cases to the Wisconsin Supreme Court and won. Wisconsin Carry et al., which is Wisconsin Carry and Tom, I'm going to forget your last name. My friend Tom. Wisconsin Carrie and Tom. Tom, why am I drawing a blank on your last name? I talk to Tom all the time. Anyway, versus City of Madison. Madison tried to prohibit carry on buses, and we were successful in that lawsuit. Gosh, Tom, why am I drawing a blank on your last name? I just emailed with him a couple days ago. Anyway, he was the co-plaintiff. He lives in Madison. He was our co-plaintiff to help give us standing in that case against Madison. Many other lawsuits sued, funded lawsuits against Marks End High School, lawsuits against Kenosha, lawsuits against Madison, lawsuits. I mean, Wisconsin Carry has done really, really, really well with lawsuits. Litigation has been our most successful strategy. And a lot of that was because we knew if we got to the Supreme Court, we were probably going to win at the Supreme Court. And that helps us with our litigation. But the problem is, if Hagedorn was flipping on some of these other, quote, conservative issues, we were worried that Hagedorn might flip on 2A issues. Now, it's good that Hagedorn ruled in a pro-gun manner here. What's not good is that Hagedorn agreed that strict scrutiny should not be applied, because we would like Wisconsin Carry pro-gun folks, you want strict scrutiny to be applied. Strict scrutiny means that you look at something as a very fundamental right, and only the only in the very limited interests of some governmental reason would you infringe on someone's rights. There has to be a really, really, really good reason to infringe on someone's rights when you apply strict scrutiny. So it would have been nice to see Hagedorn dissent to this with and agree with strict scrutiny, but he dissented, but he was in favor of, he agreed that it shouldn't be viewed as strict scrutiny. So what else we got here? I want to make another comment going back to what's gone on in D.C. this past week. This is what no one in the media will say, what not even the phony Republicans on Fox News will say. But what happened on Wednesday in D.C., this is what happens when institutions fail us. This wasn't Trump's fault. What happened on Wednesday was the fault of the people in Georgia who cheated and stole votes and ran fraudulent votes through the voting machine. It's the fault of the lying, cheating pieces of garbage who kicked out poll watchers from Georgia, from Pennsylvania, who pulled ballots from under tables and started running them through the machines with no observers present. This is the fault of elected officials who did nothing about what happened in November. This is the fault of the mainstream media for suffocating the stories about the election fraud. NBC, CBS, ABC, CNN, none of them put the video from the State Farm Arena out there for the public to see. We had to go to Newsmax, One America News, to see it. It's state Supreme Courts in multiple states who rejected these cases, not ruled against the cases brought with election fraud, but refused to hear them, refused to even hear the evidence. It's the U.S. Supreme Court's fault. It's the refusal of the Democrat Party to support auditing the vote. The easiest way to quell this anger for 75, 80 million Americans is to prove that the election, we think the election was stolen. If we're wrong, prove us wrong. You won't let us prove ourselves right. You won't even give us that day in court. Then just you prove us wrong. Audit the machines, audit the vote. If it was an honest election, the best thing for you, Democrats, the best thing for Joe Biden would be to say, yeah, look, it was legit. There's a reason why they don't want us to look. Because if this was a legit election, they'd have it out there by now. They'd have all the evidence we need. They'd have the machines available for anybody to analyze. But this is what happened on Wednesday is what happens when institutions fail. This is what you get. They left people so angry with no other recourse. And everyone's done with your gas, mainstream media. You fail the people and then you blame the people. I mean, it's just, some of the comments from Republicans this past week were just disgusting. I mean, here's Lindsey Graham. Lindsey Graham, quote, "I cannot say it more clearly. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris were fairly elected." That was a quote from Lindsey Graham. And that is how absolutely clueless these ivory tower politicians are, because no one believes Lindsey Graham and no one cares what Lindsey Graham thinks. We all know the moment Lindsey Graham realized Trump wasn't going to be president for the next 4 years, Lindsey Graham was more concerned about his political future than the future of American citizens. Lindsey Graham's word won't solve a damn thing. Does Lindsey Graham think that his word is so powerful that he can just say Joe Biden and Kamala Harris were fairly elected, and we're all going to say, oh, okay, sorry, we'll go home. The people that were in D.C., we'll go home. People like me who are just sitting here angry that the election was stolen. Oh, okay, well, I guess I was wrong. Ah, shucks. I guess there wasn't a stolen election. Only an investigation would satisfy we the people. Only an investigation is going to satisfy the 80 million people that voted for Trump. That's what they don't get. These ivory tower politicians think that, hell, if Donald Trump came out and said, look, folks, I think the election was honest. I think Biden actually did win. No one's going to believe him either. We've got eyes. So there's this thing, you know, it was interesting, like here in Wisconsin, Mike Gallagher, he makes a comment that this is why we shouldn't have been pursuing this stupid idea of challenging Electoral College, because it makes people mad and it drives people to anger and gives them false hope. The election was honest and that's the end of it. That's what what Mike Gallagher said. I mean, and then Ron Johnson came out. Ron Johnson said, look, when people feel like they didn't get recourse from their institutions, they're angry. This is what happens. And it was such a different, these are both Republicans from Wisconsin. It was such a different tone. Mike Gallagher speaks like people are just ignorant drones doing whatever Trump told them to do, or little rubes so driven to anger by legislators' efforts to use their constitutional authority to expose the vote fraud that no other branch of the government or media was willing to acknowledge. You know, one of these guys, Mike Gallagher, and so you got Mike Gallagher's response compared to Ron Johnson's. Ron Johnson treats the people's voices and actions with respect and understands and respects their position. Mike Gallagher acts like the people are peasants that were just drawn to wrongful beliefs and anger from their lord legislators, Trump or these elected Republicans who are going to push the electoral challenge. It's as if we're supposed to be hypnotized by the ruling class, according to Gallagher, thinking that we were just, Trump and these legislators had us hypnotized as, you know, Mike Gallagher has just an arrogant, elitist perception, just clueless. And it's just like these liberals, like these dumbass liberals who think that Rush Limbaugh became the biggest political figure in media because everyone who listened to him just put blind faith in whatever he said and just believed every word he said. And that's not it. And a true business person knows this. I'll explain that in a second. You know, Rush Limbaugh became who he was because he articulated what people already felt. When people started tuning into Rush Limbaugh, they didn't think, oh, well, I'd never thought of that before. Yeah, no, Rush. When people tuned into Rush, Rush would articulate things that they already felt. And they're like, yeah, that's right. Because that's how they felt. And Rush was saying it. Some people could even articulate it just as good as Rush, but they didn't have a national platform to do it. And that's what people never got. People thought, because liberals must do that. They must follow the dictates. I think liberals like to be ordered around. They have some comfort in being ordered around. Conservatives don't. Conservatives like making their own choices, thinking for themselves. And when you do think for yourself and then someone else you realize thinks the same way you do, you like to hear from them because it validates what you feel. And that's what Donald Trump only validates what we think that. Look, I'll give you a perfect example. Scott Walker chose not to pursue the fraudulent election in 2018, where he lost by 20,000 votes with an early morning vote dump in Milwaukee. Now, I'm mad at Scott Walker for not challenging that. I was mad at him then. I'm mad at him now. Scott Walker would have challenged that. Maybe we, when Scott Walker, if Scott Walker would have challenged that when we had, look, we had, they had that lame duck legislative session. They could have passed election reform laws in that lame duck legislative session after Scott Walker's election was, I believe, stolen back in 2018. Instead, they passed a bunch of other lame duck stuff to change a few things about, you know, rulemaking and other stuff with the Democrats coming in. So just because Scott Walker didn't pursue election fraud investigations in his election didn't change my mind that there was likely election fraud, didn't make me less angry. If Donald Trump didn't come out Wednesday and speak to that rally in D.C., I would still be just as angry, just as frustrated, just as concerned for the future of this country. But that's what the left doesn't get. The left thinks we're just a bunch of drones that are just following orders from our, you know, they think we're just hypnotized by Rush Limbaugh, brainwashed by Rush Limbaugh. They don't even respect us enough to believe that the things that we feel are core beliefs validated through our life's experiences. They think we just turned on Rush Limbaugh and followed his, took his opinion as what we should believe. And it's that's how misguided and how dumb liberals are. Business owners get this. Business owners understand that, you know, you are successful in business by meeting people's wants and needs, not telling them what they want and need. You give them what they want, not tell them what they want. Rush Limbaugh doesn't tell people what to believe. He expresses what they already believe in sometimes a more articulate way than they could. Anyway, so that's the show. We didn't even get to the Kenosha DA decision. I was going to talk about that. That's probably good for next week. That's probably an evergreen story. We can talk next week about Jacob Blake decision and Tony Evers' response to it. I was going to talk about the Burlington High School teacher that got suspended for going to D.C. But yeah, maybe I'll save those for next week if there still isn't some more hot topics that we need to talk about. And there will be. I mean, this isn't over. There's something's going to hit the fan. Big things are going to be happening. I don't know what they are, but something. So anyway, you guys have a great week. Carry on. Be well armed. Have a good night. Thanks, Ralph, for the comment about the show. Lon, thanks for tuning in. Tom, thanks for tuning in. And Nate, thanks for tuning in. You guys have a great week.
Stop listening to the bombastic loudmouths on the radio and television and the internet. To hell with them.
This is Sniper Chick Julie. You've been listening to Well-Armed Radio, and I have to know, is that a gun in your pants, or did you just really enjoy the show?